talk to the community itself, talk to those people over time and find out what they really do actually need.
Welcome to the Circle Holding Podcast with me, Julia Davis.
And me, Tessa Venuti-Sanderson. We are the co-authors of the book Circle Holding, A Practical Guide to Facilitating Talking Circles.
We would love for you to join us for free talks, question and answer sessions, all about the art of holding circle. You can find these at circleholding.org.
So today it's myself, Tessa, interviewing Liz, who is the co-founder of Becoming Mums and is an arts producer and artistic director of the dance organisation. So an absolute wealth of experience. Hello.
Hi, thanks so much for talking today. It's really nice to be involved in your podcast.
Thank you. And I've known you for a while because you came with Fee, who's the other co-founder, to Mum and Baby Yoga. And the Becoming Mums came all out of your experience of being a new mum. And, well, you tell us, well, why did it come about?
Yeah, so thank you for the I don't know what to call it, mum dating service that you provided. I met so many brilliant people on your yoga course and your active birth workshop. It was brilliant. Yeah, so Fee and I stayed in touch after those workshops, and about 6 months into our new motherhood journey, she went to see a theatre show called Becoming, which was a work in progress. Two amazing women with their babies on stage talking about this incredible matrescence journey, this thing that we go through. And because it was a work in progress, they opened up to the audience to ask questions or give feedback at the end. And after about 2 hours, I think the stewarding staff at the theatre had to tell everybody to leave because the audience was full of people who were just desperate to share their stories or ask questions or just so relieved to be in a space full of people who were going through the same kind of things that they were. So Fee called me and said, we need to do something about this. These women need a space to talk. And initially she suggested a theatre show, which I just said, that's ridiculous. There's no way. Come on, we've got tiny babies. But yeah, we decided we'd just hold a conversation. So we invited anybody that wanted to come and talk about birth. And about 25 people turned up and we made everyone cups of tea. And we sat for a couple of hours and talked about our birth stories. And we could have been there for another 2 or 3 hours, I think, the amount of stuff people just needed to express. And their Becoming Mums grew from there. And now, 7 years down the line, we are holding twice monthly peer-to-peer support sessions. We're running creative projects. We are supporting other organisations to access mums and postnatal people who are most in need. And we're working with all sorts of community partners and, yeah, have big plans to try and reach as many people who just need a space to be amongst people who get it. We're not mental health practitioners. We can't fix anything. We're not associated with the NHS. We're not affiliated to the council or anything like that. We are just a space where peers can come and talk and be together and can talk about themselves and not just their babies. We're trying to remove that, you know, mum and baby group thing of turning up and being just the anonymous mum in the corner that, you know, never gets to talk about themselves and who they are. So there's a lot of honesty, there's a lot of laughter, there's a lot of cake. Your babies and children of all ages are catered for. And it's a space where people can come and talk about the things that matter to them, about their journeys, work, relationships, their body, whatever it is that's needed at that time. It's an amazing space. I continue to learn from it every month. I love it.
Today, I particularly wanted to talk to you about, you know, how we finance these kinds of groups and how do we make sure that, you know, there's a lot of work goes into these things. How do we make sure it's sustainable because by having maybe some payment for yourself? But before all of that, before we get into the detail of it, I just wondered, with that very first one, did you think it was going to be a one-off, or did you already think this is going to be something that's regular?
Do you know, I can't remember. 6 months postpartum, my memories are very blurry. I can't remember. What I remember is leaving the session and crying for about 3 hours because I just felt so seen and heard. And I think at that point, there's no way I wouldn't have wanted to meet those people again and continue to build that community. So I imagine that, yes, we never thought it would be a one-off, but had it not been so well attended and so positively received, and had we not been surrounded by people saying, oh my God, I really needed this, why wasn't there something like this 6 months ago or a year ago, then yeah, maybe it would have been a one-off, maybe it would have been something entirely different. One of the really important things to us is to continue to check in with that community and asking them what is important to them. And what we're doing seems to be continue to be of need, although it's shifted over the years, it's changed shape a little bit in response to that. But yeah, I think it was always going to be a regular thing, whether we knew it or not, perhaps.
And I know I've certainly been to events that you've run where there's been a creche. Is that always the case? Or?
So there's never a creche, but we are there child-free as much as possible. Certainly that's easier now. Our kids are in school to help look after babies. We try to bring volunteers in to help with extra pairs of hands. Some of our creative courses where there have been older children present in significant numbers, we have brought in an additional person who's specifically there to help entertain them. But no, it's a peer-to-peer space. So you come with your baby. It's like a normal mum and baby group, but we're talking about ourselves, and the children are noisy and they want to play and they want to climb through the fire escape and all the usual stuff that kids want to do. And we all just muck in, you know, if you happen to be child free and you spot someone struggling, you step up and help. And that in itself sort of builds community. So the children are there in the space with toys and games and activities. And if you don't want to engage with the conversation, you still just have this really lovely, friendly play space to be at as well.
I know, you know, you were talking about creative projects. You sometimes bring artists in. I remember seeing a beautiful quilt that created and then displayed later on. So can you talk a little bit about why it was you decided to bring somebody like an artist in?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm an arts producer. I've worked in the arts for a long time and also in education. And one thing that is demonstrably, overwhelmingly known is that creativity is a really powerful tool for well-being, for your mental health, for social connection, for all sorts of things, even just opening up conversation. If we've got something in our hands and something to do, it really helps you talk. It's something you can hide a little bit behind, but actually it also opens up conversation without you realizing. So when lockdown hit, we realized that the need for support was greater than ever. I managed to secure some funding from the council to run movement classes because I also run a dance organisation. I knew some incredible practitioners and I just thought, gosh, if we can get people outdoors and just moving, at, you know, in a social way, but socially distanced with babies and slings so no one could crawl around and lick each other and cause any COVID complications. I meant the babies, not the mums. But So we managed to run 4 or 5 6-week courses exploring movement, different parts of the body with an amazing contemporary dance practitioner. And yeah, the need for that was immense. So we then went on to get some Arts Council funding to do a series of courses, specific courses over and above our normal peer-to-peer sessions. And of course, some of that has bled into the peer-to-peer sessions as well, because it's a really powerful tool. So there's a kind of combination of whole 6-week courses where you're looking at a particular art form, you're exploring your identity, your motherhood stories, your journeys as a parent with an artist in a group of people, either online or face-to-face. We've done and do both. And then there's also one-off sessions that we do in the normal peer-to-peer groups where we're making stuff or we're creating something to collaborate on a bigger project that's happening alongside. So it sort of all feeds into one another. But the Arts Council work, and we're in the middle of another Arts Council project at the moment, where again we've had these series of courses that have been they're so impactful. They're really magical spaces. You're learning something new, you're connecting with people on an incredibly deep and fundamental level. you're being creative, you're achieving something, you get to the end of the session and there's this tangible thing that you've made or you've drawn or you've written, or, you know, that you feel a sense of pride and ownership over, in a group of people who get it, who are your peers and who are going through the same kind of things you are. It's a really, really special space. And I think we're lucky that the kind of other jobs that both Fee and I do bring in these artists, and we're extremely careful about who we work with. They have to be the exactly right person. It has to be somebody who really knows how to hold space in a really loving, welcoming, safe way. Someone who can read the room very carefully and know if someone is struggling or what, you know, a flicker of anxiety might look like, who knows how to softly facilitate, very softly, to enable people to connect with one another, but who is also a good teacher of that art form, who knows how to plan sessions so that people can achieve something as complete beginners without feeling lost or, you know, overwhelmed if they're trying to do it with a newborn baby in one arm and sewing at the same time. That's really challenging. You know, what can we do that everybody can access? So those people are hard to find, especially people who are also available when we need them in Reading for 6 weeks on a trot. Like, it's quite a challenge. We're really lucky that we found some really awesome people who we've continued to work with because of the skills that they bring. And our role in that space is then just facilitating and holding the space, making sure that the participants are welcomed and held really well, and that their babies are cuddled and tea is brought to them if they need it, and if they need to take a step out of the space, that there's someone there to just talk to or sit with. If something else is going on, you know, and they need a bit of extra support, then we're there to do that.
Or if they arrive late and so, you know, the main facilitator's not pulled away, but you've got somebody else to welcome them in and get them a cup of tea and all those lovely things.
Yeah, exactly.
I was just thinking that skill set that you're talking about is something that they will have developed over years. And so what was your thinking around when you were bringing them in, what you wanted to do about paying them?
Yeah, so this is tricky. Payment for artists, practitioners, facilitators, freelancers of any genre is incredibly important. I feel really passionately about people being paid properly. And as a freelancer myself, we have to be better at doing that, and we have to be better at asking for the kind of full cost recovery of our time. Otherwise, as you said, things are unsustainable. And what we don't want is to lose any more freelancers from the market, because they really hold up the whole arts industry. So we do pay our artists really well, and we make sure that we agree those fees with people in advance, and we make sure that we don't do work where we're ever asking people to do stuff for free, because they're professionals and their time and their expertise deserves to be valued. So yeah, we have to fund those projects. They have to have funding from external sources. For a 6 week course, we do ask participants to make a nominal fee. So we'll charge them £10 for the whole 6 weeks, which covers the costs of the materials that we then buy for them. But really, it's there to secure their place, because there's a limited number of spaces. What we don't want is people signing up for free and then not coming, and other people could have come. For our normal peer-to-peer sessions, that's completely free, because there isn't really a limit on the number of people who can come other than what's safe in the space, which is way more than we ever have. I think the most we've had is 25, and the space could probably accommodate 80. So, you know, we're fine. It's all good. But yeah, so for those 6 week courses, we do charge a £10 fee, but that we will offer a free place to anybody that needs it on those courses. So some people pay and some people don't, and that's completely fine, and we never ask why or chase it up. It needs, for us, it's really important that these things are fully accessible, and in particular, you know, working in areas like Battle in Reading and in Whitley, and so we are actively seeking to support people who can't afford to pay for stuff on a regular basis. When we first started, we did ask for donations at sessions. Lots of people did donate small amounts of money, which was incredibly generous of them. We didn't have any funding at all at that time, so everything we were paying for, the room hire, everything came out of our own pockets, which became expensive quickly. And now we are funded by a number of different grant funds. So we're funded by the National Lottery and we're funded by the Arts Council at the moment. We've also had some funding from Reddingborough Council, and we've had some funding from Berkshire Community Foundation and from the Arnold Clark Community Foundation. So a big part of my job in particular, obviously hugely with fee as well, but unfortunately it's my skill set. I hate that, but it is writing really dull funding bids repeatedly, trying to explain in that irritating funding speak what it is that we do and the impact that it has. And so, yeah, so far we've managed to fund our time and our artists and our projects, as well as, you know, the everyday stuff like room hire and cakes and tea and coffee and baby toys and, you know, hand sanitizer and all the other stuff that we have to accommodate.
I think this is so important for people to hear, because it might be that somebody's planning to create a talking circle where they know the demographic isn't going to have spare cash to regularly pay to come along to something, or that it's going to be a major barrier. And I think it's really hopeful to hear that it can be done in this way. Now, you obviously had experience before you started becoming mums in getting grants, but have you got like a tip, like if somebody was just starting on this journey of thinking, I really need to secure some money, so I'm not paying out of my own pocket for the venue, and maybe I can even get some money to cover my own time and all the planning and everything. Have you got a kind of a way in? Are there sort of bodies that help new people who are not used to grant writing to get started with those skills?
There are. It depends on who you are, and I don't mean you as a person, I mean the structure of the organisation. If you're a not-for-profit, unconstituted community group, or if you're an individual trying to run classes or sessions, that has a big impact on the kind of money you can access. But what I would say before even that, before even seeking funding, is to really think about the people that you're going to work with and what it is that they need, and talk to them. Find out what their needs are, and then think about the way in which those needs can be met. What I find is that often people start these things from, I want to do a thing, and this is the thing I want to do. And it's often the case with artists who obviously work in a particular genre. You know, maybe they're wood carvers. Like, I want to carve this beautiful piece of wood into a thing. Who is it going to benefit? Rather than thinking, I want to benefit these people because there's a real need. What is the need? What's the best way to meet that need? And it might not be the activity you want to do. It might be something else altogether. When you come to funding, then, you have to be able to articulate that journey really logically. So here are the people. This is the problem. Here's the best way to solve that problem. And here's the research that demonstrates this is the best way to solve that problem. This is the money we need to do the thing to solve the problem. Rather than saying, I want to do a thing. This excites me. I wonder who it will benefit. So I think that's the best thing, starting from that viewpoint. And then if you can articulate that really clearly and your logic is sound, you can go to funders and fill in those horrendous application forms, some of which are easier than others, with that logic. And as long as that logic is clear and you're making the right decisions to have the best impact on the people who need it the most, then you just articulate that in irritating funding speak, ticking boxes and all the tokenism that comes with it. But as long as your foundations are solid, I think that makes the project solid and your delivery solid and your impact provable as well, which is also really important and really hard to do, to demonstrate on a bit of paper the change that you're bringing about. It's tough. It's really tough because it's so ephemeral and hard to pin down.
Sometimes what I see when people come to training is that they feel called to hold a circle and they're so excited about it. They're like, well, anybody can come. But then it's quite hard to answer a lot of the questions that come out about the best venue to have, or, you know, do you have a hard start time or a softer one where people can come in as and when? All those questions are answered if you can really be very specific about who it's for and who it's serving. So yeah. Thank you so much for bringing that up. I think it really underpins all the other decisions that come afterwards.
Yeah, it definitely does. And I think, you know, certainly coming from an arts perspective, a lot of community participatory projects do planning the wrong way round. They start by thinking, well, we do this thing, where can we take it? What sometimes that means is people parachute into communities that they're not a part of, deliver a thing, and then go, and they're never seen again. And either they've had no impact at all, or they've had an amazing impact that's gone in 6 months because the funding's ended and they're not embedded in that community. And that's sometimes worse than having not done it at all, to have provided a brilliant thing and then it has to go away. And that is a real problem with grant funding, this kind of work, is that you're always chasing the next pot of money to keep just the core of what you do going. And of course, funders don't like to fund the same thing over and over again. They like people to be constantly reinventing the wheel and also showing long-term impact, which is, you know, a bit of a tautology, really. You have to be embedded in those communities so that you continue to build relationships and shape that dialogue with those people rather than parachuting in and then leaving again. It's kind of the fundamentals of good community engagement, really, that it needs to be with and for the people that you're working with and really building relationships.
You mentioned before that from the original place where you were holding it, you've now gone into other areas in Reading. So did you really sort of intentionally make connections in those areas? They sort of got local allies that are helping you to know what would be most helpful?
Partly, and partly it's logistics. So initially we were meeting at Risk on London Street, which is a community space, offices, a charity is based there. And we used that space because I worked there and they very kindly let us use the space for the first few months for free, which is really generous of them. The only reason we ever left Risk was that parking became really difficult and toddlers. We had a master escapologist who we spent the whole session trying, either us or this child's parent, running into the car park to retrieve this extremely clever child who went through, and obviously Risk in all its brilliant accessibility has motion sensitive doors, which, you know, toddlers think of the best. So we had to find somewhere where we could safely contain children that can escape, so that their parents can relax and not stress about their kids running off and getting run over. So unfortunately, we had to leave Risk and we went to Fairview Community Centre, which is on Great Knollys Street, which is in West Reading in Battle, where I live and have been for a very, very long time, and where other organisations we know and have worked with are also based. So it was a good choice for multiple reasons. Also, you can't get out the front door without pressing security button. That's great. It's good. And of course, it has to be wheelchair accessible and we have to be able to get to hot water for tea and coffee. And there has to be good changing facilities and enough space for buggies and all of those factors that genuinely rule out a lot of spaces. Actually, there isn't a huge amount to choose from. We also work at Hexham Road in North Whitley, which was a specific choice for its location. It's also a great space. It works for all those logistic reasons, but we chose it because we wanted to work in that particular community. Whitley in South Reading area is huge, and there's a lot of provision in the South Reading hub on Northumberland Avenue, where there's a library and a children's centre, and the health visitor team is based there, and the, you know, health centre is literally just a couple of doors down, and a, you know, big community spaces. There's lots of provision there, but actually the north bit of Whitley's quite far away and there's nothing, absolutely nothing but this barely used community space. So yeah, we were really excited to end up working at Hexham Road, and it has taken a while for us to build relationships there and to bring in local people. When we first started, we were bringing our own existing members with us and they were really excited to have a session on a different day for those that couldn't make the normal Thursdays. But actually we did a lot of community outreach. We did a lot of flyering in shops and cafes and children's centres. We did a lot of work with other organisations who are based in Whitley to help get the message out. We participated in big community events like Whitley Carnival, banners on playgrounds, just so people knew it existed. We had big flags made so we could put them outside the community centre when we're in the space, talking to the health visitor teams and midwife teams, everybody we could, plus also doing a big push on health outreach. So getting posters into doctor's surgeries, into spaces where people with children will be. And so that over time has built connections with local parents around the Hexham Road area, which is exactly what we aimed for in that particular place. And it's a different group. It has a slightly different vibe. We talk about different stuff because each group lead on what they want to talk about each month. So it's not necessarily the same in both sessions. Some people come to both, or one or the other, whichever one they're free for. And obviously those who are local will come to the local one to them. So it's a mix. It's a different group of people each time with some kind of core regulars. And that's really lovely. There's no kind of cliqueiness to it. But yeah, each has its own kind of vibe as a group.
Because before you were talking about space holding, and that's one of the questions I was going to ask is whether in different places you almost need to explain it in a different way or perhaps have different guidelines as you start off the talking about how it's going to work. Or have you got any sort of experiences you can share around those different needs?
I think the group dictate the session, and Fee and I are quite responsive facilitators. So we'll go in with a topic that the group have decided they want to talk about, and we'll have a really vague idea of a way of facilitating dialogue. And typically that's just writing bits down in small groups and then talking as a big group, or pair work, or something as simple as that. There's never anything complex to it, but it's about making sure everyone has a space to say something if they want to, and a space to retreat if they don't want to, and guiding that kind of sharing section. So it's quite informal, and it's really very much led by them. So we're really responsive to what comes out in those sessions, and we're listening really, really carefully and following their lead, because it's their session, it's not ours. We don't want to go to it with an agenda of, you know, we're going to achieve this by the end of the group. You know, it's about them talking about the things that matter to them. And sometimes we're off on a completely different tangent, and that's completely fine. And sometimes we have completely open spaces where people set the agenda themselves in the space in the moment. I often use a kind of open space forum technology to enable people to prioritize the things they really want to talk about that time. So they're really different every time. Sometimes we will bring in a craft, and that's a whole different session altogether. And often we're just sat chatting and, you know, eating snacks and making something. And that's also really lovely, because people don't have the chance to do that. And you've got small children clamoring at you all day long to have 2 hours to sit and make something quietly, or just chatting about whatever to the person who sat next to you whilst we're keeping an eye on their kids. I think is that in itself is a really cathartic process to go through. So yeah, they are all quite different. Sessions are quite different, and we don't go with a set format or a set sort of agenda about what that's going to look like.
And over the years of holding these groups, what's something that you've learned about holding space, kind of a personal reflection? Do you still have an edge, something that's sort of like, ooh?
Oh gosh, there's so many things to navigate, and we're still learning all the time. I'm constantly in awe of how much I learn from the people I talk to and the things that I'm involved with. I think one of the biggest lessons has been the power of creativity. A simple, easy to access creative tasks are hugely impactful, and social connection. The thing we start every session with is permission giving. So we make sure that people know that they are welcome in that space exactly as they are, however they're feeling, whatever's going on. They're told explicitly they don't have to shush their kids. They don't have to try and make their kids be anything other than what they are in that moment, in that space, in that time. That's really important. You can visibly see people relax when they hear that, because coming into a space where, you know, there's an activity or you're talking, you sort of feel like, oh, I have to make my kid behave, I have to pay attention, or, you know, don't want that. We want people to just be as they are and feel welcome in whatever state they're currently in. So that permission thing is really important, and I think that enables people to engage with what we're talking about. And it has to be peer-to-peer. It has to be the group supporting one another. You know, if we come in as some kind of authority figure, which we're obviously not, it changes the dynamic. And when we have brought guests in, if they've been peers, it's incredibly impactful. Sometimes we've brought in people who aren't peers or people perhaps from the NHS, or and actually it doesn't work so well. It doesn't work well at all because people feel there's a barrier. You can't share. There becomes a hierarchy in the space that we've worked really hard to remove. So yeah, I think that's one of the really key learning points there, is about keeping it a space for and by those people and making them feel that they are completely welcome as their whole selves in that space.
Such an interesting reflection, because for me, a lot of what a talking circle about is that everybody has equal chance to say something if they wish to, and hence some of the time you will be in a physical circle. It's not that you're in lines sitting one behind the other, and that as a facilitator, there's a kind of a fine line that you're walking where you are creating that structure. And then, as you so beautifully said before, you're getting out the way. You don't have the agency. You know, you're not trying to lead something once you've set up the space.
Yeah.
You're there creating the space, but you're also making sure that you're not sort of seen as an authority figure, or that you've got more power than somebody else. There's a lot going on when you start to look at it.
Yeah, there is. There really is. And I think for me personally, a lot of that learning came from my career before Becoming Mums arrived and before my son arrived, which was in teacher training around global citizenship and diversity and inclusion work. So I spent 15 years facilitating sometimes very difficult conversations with people in a work context where perhaps we might be talking about things like racism or homophobia, and trying to address issues that were taking place amongst staff in a school, coming in cold to a group I've never met before and trying to talk about some really controversial topics. And you learn really fast how to hold that space gently, but also guide people whilst sort of taking them with you. And there's a lot of we in that space and not me. I can't come in as an authority figure on anything and say, well, you need to do it this way, because immediately there's a barrier. And that's easy to do with Becoming Mums, because Fee and I built it because we needed it too. It really was. It came from this sort of, you know, for me anyway, this need to be seen and to be amongst my peers and to find my people, my tribe, you know, and to not be going to brilliant mum and baby groups, but ones where no one ever asked me my name or what I thought about the world or anything, where I felt invisible. I remember trying to connect with another mum at a council-run baby group by telling her what I'd been watching on Netflix. And I'd been watching Glow. Do you remember that Glorious Ladies of Wrestling thing? But I described it so badly because I was sleep deprived. I just said I've been watching women wrestling on Netflix. She's like, okay, that's not really my thing, and just left the space. I was mortified. It's like, well, I'm never doing that again. So I really felt this need to connect with people over something other than just my baby. I didn't want to just be mum, you know, anonymous, invisible mum. And so, yeah, the group came from that need. So we are authentically members of the group. You know, obviously it's different now. Our children are older, and we continue to bring in team members and volunteers who still have little children, because that perspective is really important, because you do forget so much.
As your children get older and you move away from that sort of baby time and those very sleepless nights, do you think there'll come a point where you sort of stand back a little bit and you train some people up who have the younger children? Is that something that you would consider?
Yeah, if it was needed, absolutely. As you go through the parenting journey, you also stumble upon other groups of people who are going through something else that it was completely invisible to you until you fell into that, you know, room as well. You know, whether that's people going through perimenopause stuff, or people who suddenly find themselves caring for a parent as well as their young children, or, you know, all these sorts of other phases of life that we don't know anything about until they appear, right? We don't talk about them enough. And I know you're a huge advocate for talking about these things more and more honestly and openly, and it's so important. So, yeah, you know, whether that changes what Becoming Mums is, or whether simply we make sure there are people there who can facilitate, who have current experience of small children, yeah, all of those things are on the table. We really genuinely are led by the needs of the group. So what they tell us is working or not working, we listen really carefully to.
Going back to the sort of financial aspect of it, another thing I wanted to ask you about was, from being a community interest group to working towards charity status, what will be the benefits of getting that charity status?
Oh, that's a really interesting question, Tessa.
A big question.
Yeah, it's a controversial question, I think, in a way, and I don't think we've got time for me to rant about, you know, the sort of patriarchal capitalist structures of grant funding. But having charity status enables us to access funding that we wouldn't normally be able to access. It lends a credence to your organisation because you are being checked by the Charity Commission, with your policies and procedures, your filing accounts every year. They're looking at how you operate. You have to have a board of trustees who also hold you to account. So we can't take money and run off to the Bahamas and have a holiday with it. And that stuff's really important. To be accountable is really, really important. So when we got funding from the National Lottery nearly two years ago, they said, we're happy to fund you, but you should probably think about some kind of formal structure. And at that point, we looked at the various options, community interest company, we looked at a charity or a company linked to a guarantee. And then we looked at what we're working towards now, which is a CIO, a charitable incorporated organization, which gives you proper, legitimate charity status, but also has a touch of other elements in it that enable you not to do double reporting. So it's long and complicated, but have a look at CIO. It's a good structure. You are a fully registered charity. And it lends that authority and that sort of safety to funders offering you money. And it means you have to be accountable to the people that you're working with. You can't do it because you can't do stuff just because you want to. You have to think really carefully about what you're doing and who it's for. And it holds the people you're serving at the heart of everything that you do, at the heart of your organisation. But the paperwork is a nightmare. But the board of trustees are amazing. I would recommend having one, even if you don't need one, just a group of awesome people that offer you support and advice and help. I mean, how incredible is that? We're really lucky to have the people that we have. And we are looking for extra people, so give us a shout if you're interested. I always recommend having some kind of steering group or group of people from that community who can just support you and hold you a little bit and help you, because it's a lot, especially if you're doing stuff on your own. Working in isolation is tough.
But you don't end up in your own echo chamber, yeah, but that you keep making sure it's relevant.
Yeah. If you find a group of people that you want to support in some way, I would say the first thing to do is to look really carefully and see what's already happening, because it's almost certain that there's going to be somebody somewhere doing something amazing to support these people. It almost certainly will never be enough. You know, there's no shortage of people who need good support. But look and see what's already happening and look how that's put together and look, talk to those people about where the other gaps are that they're unable to meet, and get a really accurate picture of that community and what's happening, and talk to the community itself, talk to those people over time and find out what they really do actually need. Test some stuff out, run some sessions, do some free things, have a drop-in coffee session or whatever you can to engage with those people and get them talking to you and trusting you and liking what you maybe have to offer.
What's your feeling? What do you get from it? You know, at the end of the day, when you see the group actually happening and the benefit.
The end result is being part of change. And I think that's incredibly powerful. It's really easy in the current state of the planet to be horribly overwhelmed and end up despondent and paralyzed by how genuinely awful everything is. And I think especially as parents, it's particularly terrifying to look at the state of the climate, to look at the state of our politics, to look at the discussions around, you know, trans rights and everything that's happening in an increasingly divisive and hostile community. It's really scary. But if we have something practical to do that we know makes a difference, to build community, to build trust, to build connection, to be part of change, it's hugely self-satisfying, it's hugely warming and gratifying and impactful yourself, but you see change happening and then you have hope and that's contagious. So if people around you also see change happening, things happen because of it. You know, people make friendships that last them their lives. That's a huge change to someone's mental health. That's enough, you know, that kind of stuff. It's enough. We can't fix all of the problems, but there are things we can do.
I think we should finish there. You've just kind of encapsulated the magic that can come out through bringing people together. Thank you so much, Liz, for sharing some of your expertise.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's hard-earned expertise from lots of other people's expertise. You know, you gather bits, don't you, and put it all together. And these conversations are so enriching. They make my brain think of a thousand other things and make connections that are really impactful. So thank you for your time, not just today, but over the years as well.
I wish becoming mums, you know, all the best going forwards, going from strength to strength.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to the Circle Holding podcast. I've been Tessa Venuti Sanderson.
And I've been Julia Davis. We would love for you to rate and review this podcast. A 5-star rating means more people will find us.
We're the co-authors of the book Circle Holding, A Practical Guide to Facilitating Talking Circles.
Thank you for joining us today.
You can find our trainings at circleholding.org. We hope that you find a community where you can be authentically you very soon.